You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mahaere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rātū Tuesday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Vihan. If I can, coming up on the show for Dear Science this week, our expert Dr. Kushla McGovern chats with us about bacteria using a corkscrew technique, the financial costs of period pain, and hygiene in Pompeii's baths. For Green World, Tuesday Wire host Sarah spoke with Dr. Kevin Trenberth about what drives the extreme weather conditions experienced in New Zealand, as well as University of Auckland lecturer Sasha Meher about the kind of political response necessary. Vihan, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke to National MP Ryan Hamilton about last week's landslide in Mount Maunganui and the government's response to climate change. I also spoke to the PSA's National Secretary, Fleur Fitzsimmons, about the privatisation of meat inspections and its potential impacts on one of New Zealand's key exports.
Whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Wai Marane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e wareware e ahana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rukiruki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o Erirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Yes, and for Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
And what a sciencey day we have for us with these three science stories. God, it feels great to be back in this seat. Corkscrew bacteria, what are these guys up to?
Yeah, so this is, last year we talked about a story about where it had been recently discovered a new way that bacteria move. And so when I saw this one, I was like, oh yeah, this is a good one. It's a bit of a follow-up in that we seem to have learned a lot about how bacteria move in the last couple of years, right? Because we've known for a long time that some bacteria, they have basically a tail. It's called a flagella, and it kind of rotates and moves, and bacteria can move through liquids and stuff. And the story we talked about last year was where they can set up a chemical gradient that they kind of swoosh across the surface. Well, today, these bacteria make themselves into basically like a screw or a corkscrew through a constrained channel. So what it turns out is you get some insects will have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria. So they want the bacteria in them because the bacteria do something for them,
right,
and the bacteria get food. So it's a good deal. So symbiotic, it's good for both.
Mm-hmm.
But to get these bacteria to get into the right places in these insects, which is a symbiotic organ, they've got to go through these really thin passages that are like 1 micron or less. So it's about the size of the bacteria.
Right.
And so with some modelling, if you do that and you look at, okay, do these bacteria just, you know, wag their tail, rotate their tail?
Yeah.
Did they go through? And it's kind of, no, they just kind of stir up the fluid, but they don't really move. So
right.
How are they getting through? And so what these scientists did was they were able to use what's called fluorescence imaging. So they basically made the bacteria glow. And what they noticed is these bacteria can actually flick up their sort of flagella, their tails, and wrap it around them in basically like the thread on a screw.
Yeah.
And that, and then they can kind of propel themselves through these channels by basically kind of corkscrewing themselves down. And so there's some really awesome pictures in this paper of like imaging this, but it's kind of quite funky, and it's like these bacteria have basically evolved to use quite a mechanical process to navigate this quite complex environment of this minor sort of gap in that. And obviously then we always go, okay, how can we use this? So, you know, people are developing micro robots. So is this something that they can adapt to that, and having these micro drilling micro robots?
Because I'm guessing we can't get screws that small, right?
Not that I know of. Maybe some people have managed to do something in the, like the micro fabrication space that are, you know, doing that. But Yeah, it wouldn't be easy.
Yeah, very interesting. And then this next one, the cost of period pain. What's this about?
So this is a social science study. Yeah. So this is where you're basically using humans as your instrument for measurement. And so it's an Australian-based study where they were interested in the cost to productivity or the loss in productivity caused by just period pain or heavy menstrual bleeding, which are the two most common things of problematic menstruation, right?
Yeah.
And so they basically did a survey of almost 1,800 women in Australia to see what were the kind of the relates that people had period pain, heavy menstrual bleeding and such, because obviously females make up a reasonable part of the population. And it's kind of basically from averaging from about 12 years of age, women will have their first period, and then every 21 to 34 days and up until they're about 45 to 55 when it starts to slow down till it stops at menopause. So it happens quite a lot over for a lot of people for a bit of time.
Maybe it's a significant issue we should research.
So there has been a bit of research around this, not so much looking at the cost of productivity. So some previous research had said that about 90% of women experience some form of period pain, and this survey found that it was 97% had experienced period pain in the last 3 months. 75% said it was always.
Wow.
So that's high already. Yeah. In terms of heavy menstrual bleeding, it was about 20 to 25%, and so these period pain and that, there's stuff like headaches, that's cramps, that's heavy menstrual bleeding, you start to get iron loss, so you get fatigue. So these do actually have a physiological effect, but it obviously also then, because it is still a taboo subject to people, people try and hide that it's affecting them or and stuff, and so they're trying to work at the same rate. So you get these things called absenteeism or presenteeism. So either someone just doesn't go to work, they take the day as leave or unpaid leave, that's absenteeism. Or they turn up to work, but they're not at 100%. They're not, doing as much as they normally would. So that's presenteeism.
Yep.
And so these obviously cost in terms of productivity because you're not working to the level that you could. And so by using these numbers of the percentage of these women that were suffering from period pain and heavy menstruation, they could do some calculations. And there are various models, but the model that's kind of in the mid-range kind of put the cost to productivity at $14 billion to the Australian economy.
Yeah.
It's a massive amount.
It's a massive amount, right? I saw this headline and I was like, is it a B or an M?
Yeah,
$14 billion.
That's so much money.
It is. And this study only looked at women that had been employed or were volunteering for the previous 3 months to when the survey was conducted. It didn't look at the unpaid work people do, so childcare, caring things, so there's all that as
where
well,
where women are overrepresented as well.
Exactly.
Wow.
And it didn't look at the costs of medical care or treatment, because of course at the very least a lot of women are taking ibuprofen or Panadol or something, but then there's a whole lot of other, depending on how bad it is, people might have to go to the doctor and stuff, so there's all those costs as well. So it's likely an underestimate, which is kind of scary. But they were also just using this to make the point that we treat it as a very private issue, but it's probably not, it's not clever, right?
Yeah.
Because it's happening to, so much of your population. So at least workplaces should be starting to think about it, whether that's reproductive leave or that's flexible working, hybrid working, which we've obviously all become a lot more familiar with, but also flexible working hours, so the rest periods, so that people still do their work, but maybe it's done more to their physiology.
Yeah.
But then also going, well, maybe governments should actually be looking at this, given all workplaces are going to face
solutions. No.
Yeah. 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 And so there have been some studies around that have started to look at what is the cost to an economy of putting in reproductive leave versus the cost if you don't. And I think it's in Australia as well. It was basically, yes, it costs a lot of money to offer reproductive leave, which is kind of the term that they've given it, but it costs a lot more not to. And I think hopefully in the next few years we start to see a bit more discussion, at least in this space.
I mean, $14 billion seems like a pretty cut and dry number.
It's big, right?
Yeah.
And, you think, there'd be some benefit to considering this.
Mm.
I mean, is it also because some workplaces are generally very male-dominated, so...
You can imagine that across... Yeah, it would be really interesting. Like, they didn't consider... It was actually one of the things this paper had put into their limitations and future outlooks, was looking at the type of work, right?
Yeah.
Because they didn't do that. They just was work. And so I imagine that, yeah... probably varies very much across the different fields and the gender domination within them.
Majority men.
Yeah.
And you're like a few women, it's kind of hard to talk about what's happening. Mm. So,
Yeah.
And then this last one, Pompeii public bath hygiene. What's going on in those baths? Is it like, I saw this headline and I thought, like, poor hygiene, but what does that mean for them, right? Is everyone dirty back then? What's going on?
Yeah, no. So it's a little bit of, people were probably a little bit dirty, and it was also that the bath wasn't really getting cleaned out.
Right.
Which is actually, in a way, good for the study, because if they had been regularly, like, really scouring their bath, they wouldn't have anything to study.
Interesting.
So Pompeii, an absolutely amazing site, archaeologist's dreamland, right? Because it's so well preserved, and it gives us such a snapshot in time of Roman culture at that time. So Pompeii was basically Mount Vesuvius erupted in 79 Common Era. It covered the place in ash, and so that's why it's a snapshot, because everything got really well preserved. And so each year you kind of hear about new things that are being discovered, and like mosaics where the colour is still really vibrant and this sort of thing. But it was a Roman city of the time, and so it had public bathhouses because public or bathing was important as part of a cultural thing.
Yeah.
So it had three major public bathing houses: Republican, Stabian, and Forum. Now, bath needs water. Pompeii didn't have a close-by, easily accessible natural water source.
Right.
So
employing those classic Roman aqueducts?
Well, not at the start.
Right.
So first off, they had to use wells or they had to collect the rainwater. So these wells, they would dig down to, the deepest were about 40 metres. But the groundwater was at like 27 to 30 metres. So you had to use a lot of people power to fill the bath. And then you'd heat the bath in these bronze sort of vessels and stuff. And you'd fill the bath and people would bathe through the day. And then it wasn't till about 33 before Common Era, so kind of the turn of the millennium there, that the aqueduct came in. So then it was this Aqua Augusta, or the Sereno Aqueduct, then started supplying Pompeii. And then it was using a natural spring. And so the water changed quite a lot, because when it was coming out of the groundwater, the well, it had a lot of minerals and stuff in it, and you couldn't really drink it. But when it came from the natural spring, now you could drink it, and it was a very different profile to the chemicals that were in it.
Yeah.
But it was always what we call hard water. So you know, like when you see a jug and it's got the white stuff that's caked on the inside?
Yeah.
We call that hard water. It's basically, it's got calcium carbonate in
it.
Water evaporates, it precipitates out. And this is what happened in these baths and these wells and these aqueducts. You've got these big or these thick deposits of this calcium carbonate. So in some areas it's up to 3 centimetres thick.
Wow.
So they've sampled that.
Yeah.
And studied that. And so this has given them a chemical record of what was going on. And so by looking at this, what they could start to tell is, because they could sample the water from the natural spring and the wells as it is now, they could know something about the chemistry of that water. So they could look at the calcium carbonate across these different baths and regions, and they could start to go, okay, the water came from there and the water came from there at this time. So they know when the aqueduct came in. They know when the aqueduct came in, the Republican bathhouse got shut down, so it was only ever well water.
Right.
And so by looking at that well water in that Republican bathhouse, they could see that. But what they could also do is look at the carbon and oxygen isotopes, and they could see in the well what the profile looked like, and then they could compare it to the where the actual bathing, the pool was, and the drainage. And they could see that the carbon-13 decreased. Now, carbon-13 is a reflection of the water itself and the geology, but it's also a reflection of microbial activity. And because we've got what's happening in the pools. Well, people are getting in, they're bathing.
Yeah, right.
Right, and then in the drains, that's where the water's going out. So they've interpreted this change in the carbon-13 as actually, it's probably that you had some microbes growing, and then you actually had human waste, like the urine and the sweat and stuff off people. And so it's kind of implying that the water wasn't changed regularly, like maybe each day sort of thing. So go for a bath in the morning, not in the evening, because in the evening
it's probably quite rank.
Yeah.
And then imagine if you're everyone pulling it up out of a well, you don't really want to change it more than once a day.
Exactly right. Yeah. So once you went to the aqueduct system, where it was a lot easier, it kind of became a bit cleaner. And so because they were able to, in the Stabian baths, it had an older region and a newer region, and so they could compare them. And that's it.
Right. That's very interesting. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for coming in, Kushla. Thank you for sharing these science stories with us. Thank you, as always, to Motet, and thank you, science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Motet, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Garth, Garth, where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no hat, no play summer, so it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Splore is back for the summer, so if you want to win a pass to a party like no other, with an insane lineup by a pristine beach, with a bunch of friends you haven't met yet, then grab that B card and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive all week for your chance to win.
Splore 2026, Beachside, Tāpapakanga Regional Park, February 20th to 22nd. Get your tickets at splore.net.
Audio. Culture.
Tune in to 95BFM Drive every second Tuesday as they're joined by one of our friends from Audio Culture, sharing the songs, stories and salacious scandal from which is woven the mighty tapestry of New Zealand music.
Audio Culture, more cultured than a blue cheese with a BA. Every other Tuesday on 95BFM Drive.
Thanks to Audio Culture. Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
It's music.
95BFM.
Broadcast to the world and podcast to your device. Go to 95BFM.com for show podcasts.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Bloom by Ethan Rayner.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week's landslide in Mount Maunganui had severe consequences on people and the environment. I spoke to National MP Ryan Hamilton about last week's landslide and the government's response to it, as well as climate change in general. What will the government's response be going forward to last week's landslide on Mount Maunganui?
Well, firstly, can I just acknowledge, obviously, those that were affected by the slides in the mountain, Welcome Bay. Obviously, it was a tragedy for the families and friends of those involved. And it was pleasing to see they had a vigil, I think, over the weekend as well, just to acknowledge those that passed. Obviously, tragic, and the whole country was watching in horror as that unfolded over the last week. And obviously, still some pretty upsetting weather events through the country. So certainly in a challenging time for us. In terms of the government response, I think you've heard from the PM and Minister Mark Mitchell saying that they're going to be looking into, what they can do next in terms of support, service and inquiry, even whether that's financial or just resourcing or whatever that might look at. And I think he's going to make some decisions or announcements in the next few days on that.
Will the slide change the government's approach to building climate resilient infrastructure in the regions?
I think it just actually affirms we're on the right track. I mean, you might recall in October last year, we released New Zealand's first adaption framework, which was a roadmap to try and help us as a country better prepare for the effects of climate. That focused on risks and response, sharing roles, responsibilities, investment, where insurance companies fit into the mix, where councils fit into the mix. I mean, I was on the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee when we worked on that. And I mean, it's really hard because we're trying to provide a framework that is fit for purpose across New Zealand, but of course within different locations across the country you've got different stress points, areas that are potentially more vulnerable than others. So it was sort of a high level framework to start to shape that conversation. And I think where we're at now is trying to pull together data that is representative of New Zealand, but also has nuance to those local communities, for example, Dunedin or some of the coastal communities that might experience things differently. Coastal communities, Coromandel, if there's rising water levels or, again, potential for slips. Like obviously we've seen some up north with the Brinduin Highway. So I think that's, to answer your question, I think it affirms that we are actually making inroads on that. And I guess the challenge is, we can't do it quickly, we've got to do it thoroughly, and so it's a very dynamic process. Later this year we're going to be releasing a national flood map, which will be you know, key for ensuring councils have adaption plans, particularly for vulnerable areas, and that's expected to be introduced, I think, about April, May to Parliament, and then obviously it'll go through the normal process of submissions and input and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of work in train, and I think relatively across government, across all parties, there's a sense that we need to do this. Obviously, it'll vary across parties, but I think as a collective, New Zealand's very conscious of the fact that we can't always do things the same way.
The national government previously scrapped a $6 billion fund to manage floods. In retrospect, was that a good plan?
Yeah, I mean, again, the PM's talked about that. I mean, we're reinvesting in these things that I've talked about. I mean, even with our roads of national significance, I mean, for example, I know my colleague Grant McCullum always talks about the Brinduans. The current road and corridor is actually still in quite a challenged environment where slips are still, you know, a lot of potential, whereas the new route would be a lot more resilient. And this is where, I guess, we get flack sometimes for talking about roads and not being environmentalists. But actually good roading infrastructure can actually reinforce, if it's done well, can actually be sustainable, it can be enduring. And in times of crisis, you want to make sure that your road and corridors are robust and can hold up when, you know, more vulnerable areas might not be. And, you know, so there's a lot of work we're doing in that space. And as I mentioned, the flood management plan. Later this year, Minister Mark Mitchell's also looking to introduce a change to the Civil Defence Emergency Management Act, because he's been obviously on the front line over the last 18 months with several incidences, and I think he's seen firsthand the variations that we get across regions and councils and even civil defence authorities and how they respond, you know, who's responsible, how do we engage iwi Māori, how do we engage rural communities, what are the pools or compliance orders, etc. So that's also underway. I think he's hoping to introduce that shortly as well. So there's sort of a suite of work, I think, that's coming in to try and develop a more comprehensive and fit-for-purpose a suite of changes, I guess. So, yeah, there's a lot of work going on in that space.
Now, given that Maunganui is actually also a very popular tourist spot, how will the government ensure tourism to the regions isn't affected in the future due to natural events like this one?
Again, I mean, you know, there's always going to be acts of God that are beyond our control, but I think the better we can identify those hotspots and those, I guess, vulnerabilities across our ecosystems, be they, you know, tourist spots or more remote areas, I think the need to have a robust framework still applies. Obviously, tourism, you know, when there's an economic impact, that affects us and affects that location quite strongly. But I think we've got to also take a whole of New Zealand approach, because, you know, if it's affecting human lives, then, you know, you can't differentiate between one or the other. They're all important. But the framework and the flood mapping and all that stuff, I think, will start to hopefully crystallise or help us sequence or prioritise the areas which we need to perhaps, you know, or where we're able to mitigate those areas as a priority.
And how will the government support the families who have lost their loved ones in the landslide?
I believe the Prime Minister will be making further announcements regarding those events in the next few days.
And what sort of plans will the government come up with to tackle climate change in the wake of this landslide, just in general?
I think it's just, like, as I've said, I mean, we've got a suite of work underway. We've launched the National Adaption Plan. We've got a flood map coming out. We've got civil defence emergency amendments coming up to make that more fit for purpose. So there's a whole suite of things we're doing and in train. And in fact, I don't think we could accelerate any of that work, because I think we've got to make sure it's done well, not rushed. But I think the events of the last week or two have just confirmed that we need to continue with that work, and we will.
That was National Party MP Ryan Hamilton talking about the Mount Maunganui landslide.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
What's this button do? Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
As New Zealanders across the Motu witness the fallout of extreme weather, including landslips and flooding, climate experts reiterate the importance of connecting these events to a wider trend of increased frequency and intensity climate events. In particular, experts including Dr. Kevin Trenberth and sustainability lecturer Sasha Mayer say that New Zealand's existing infrastructure needs to be upgraded to account for how future national disasters and climate events will impact Aotearoa. For Green World this week, news teamer Sarah spoke to both of these experts about the challenges New Zealand will face on this issue. First, Sarah spoke to University of Auckland affiliated climate scientist Dr. Kevin Trenberth about the drivers of extreme weather conditions, starting out by asking how they reflect a larger pattern of temperature change.
So global warming is certainly happening. The oceans are at record high levels in 2025, and there's an especially warm spot around New Zealand and especially just to the east of New Zealand across towards the Chatham Islands. Exceptionally warm, record high levels. A warmer ocean is vulnerable to a lot of evaporation of moisture into the atmosphere. But there's an overall pattern to the weather at the moment, which is related to the phenomenon called El Niño, or in this case, the opposite of that, La Niña conditions, which is cool conditions in the tropical Pacific from the dateline across to the Americas. And instead, it's been quite warm north of Australia, around Indonesia and so on, and a lot of convection and rain has occurred in that area. There's been a lot of rain in Queensland earlier in the year. From about May onwards, I think, there was a lot of rain in southwest Queensland, and it led to a new lake or a revision of a lake called Lake Eyre in the middle of Australia. That lake doesn't have any rivers that flow out, and as a result, the water just sits there and eventually evaporates. But they've had a lot of rain in that area, and also on the east coast, they've had quite a bit of storms on the east coast of Australia. But at the moment, there's a huge, wide atmospheric river, is what I will call it, coming from all the way from Indonesia down through the Coral Sea, the North Tasman Sea, right towards New Zealand. And embedded within it, there are several disturbances. You might call them weak tropical cyclones. They're not strong wind systems, but that is causing some of the flooding that has occurred in Northland and in Auckland here. You know, it's been raining continuously for the last day and a half at least. Mm. And then there was, you know, rain earlier, and even earlier in January and late December, there was quite a bit of rain in all of this area. And it's really brought about by the pattern of sea temperatures across the entire Pacific, and plus global warming, and it's producing exceptional rains in New Zealand at the moment and leading to flooding and a lot of difficulties.
Why is it important to understand ocean temperature changes when looking at natural disasters and the flooding and severe rain that we're seeing taking place in Aotearoa?
Global warming arises from the changes in composition of the atmosphere, mostly a buildup of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is about 53% higher than it was in pre-industrial times. It produces global warming along with increases in methane, and there are other complications from things like pollution. A lot of that heat ends up in the ocean. Over 90% of it ends up in the ocean. It's quite an involved process getting it into the ocean because the ocean is stably stratified. That means there's warm water on top of cold, and so getting more warm water into the ocean takes quite a bit of action from tides and winds and so on, mixing it down. And that's sort of the memory of global warming. And that's what is coming back to haunt us now.
Yeah, in that vein, in the coming years, what are you expecting to be the key climate challenges that we face in this country?
Yes, so it's not the same pattern every year, but this pattern we've got right now is somewhat similar to what happened in early 2023. And that's when there was major flooding in the Auckland area with over 250 millimeters of rain in one day on the 27th of January. And then later on, there was Tropical Cyclone Gabrielle that produced enormous problems all through the north and eastern parts of New Zealand. And so it doesn't happen every year. because it depends upon things like the El Nino phenomenon. I think this La Nina is likely to die in about a month or so, and we will maybe go into a weak El Nino, or it's not clear exactly what will happen. But, on you know, all of this is sort of embroidery, if you like, on top of global warming. And the fact that the oceans are warming, and that means that there is more moisture going into the atmosphere, that when it does rain, it rains harder, and the risk of flooding is greater. And so what we have to worry about around New Zealand are two things. One is coastal. Rising sea levels goes along with that, and coastal erosion, and then all of the heavy rains and flooding. And this relates to having a really good look at drainage systems. Too many places around New Zealand have been built in what used to be floodplains. At the time, they were maybe cleaned up a little bit by putting drains in of some sort, but often those drains were not adequate to deal with the kinds of torrents of water that are occurring now. And having another look at, you know, what has happened in the past and where houses have been built or other structures have been built and what the flow of water is in that vicinity could help prepare for some of the flows of water that we may expect in the future. And, you know, where the worst rains occur varies. That's just sort of part of the weather. But it happens somewhere in and around New Zealand all the time these days. We've seen earlier, you know, flooding in the Nelson area, for instance, and Canterbury. And so this is where New Zealand, I think, is quite vulnerable, and it's certainly worth having a really good look at the infrastructure.
Following this interview, Sarah spoke to University of Auckland lecturer Sasha Mayer about the political response to these observable climate impacts.
This past week alone of extreme weather has been another poignant reminder that a lot of people in New Zealand are quite vulnerable to flooding and to extreme weather conditions. You've spoken previously about the need in this space for genuine innovation rather than risk management. Could you delve into this issue a little bit?
Yeah, what I mean really is more around the need to think innovatively around transformation as an opportunity, so a positive experience, rather than taking a risk management approach, which is very much, you know, it is very much seeing these things which are out of my control, threatening my life or my livelihood, and to have a negative feeling around climate change or around adaptation. So to begin with, just reframing the conversation and having a real good think around what actually risk means and who's defining risk, and then who's putting, is risk about just about money? So is it just about property? Because there are a whole lot of other things that also are at risk of being lost because of climate impacts, and that's not just about property. It's also about people's cultural and social values and the way they feel about where they live and also their possessions. So, you know, thinking about what does actually risk mean and who's defining risk? Is it just the government? Is it just the government of the day? Is it insurers that are defining what risk means to us? Because obviously I'd be quite concerned around that because they have distinct profit motives. So, yeah, just broadening out the conversation and maybe thinking about climate change other than just thinking about managing risk is probably the good place to start. I mean, just to carry on that conversation, you know, there are some things that we cannot manage. There are some things that are truly out of our control as well with climate change, and having an upfront conversation around what they might be and then what should we do to cope with the fact that there might be things that we can't manage away.
Yeah, speaking on this, the importance of how we frame this issue and like the kind of things that we address and the kind of priorities I suppose we have, whether it's economic or social, who do you think should have more of a say or be more central, I suppose, in terms of decision making? What kind of framework do you think that we should have in terms of how this conversation is had and whose voices are kind of centered in this space in order to ensure that we're doing the right things by the right people?
Yeah, to begin with, it has to be a democratic public conversation, and it has to be well-resourced, so it can't be under-resourced in terms of who comes to the table. And what's really important, and what I've seen over and over and over again with policy conversations in New Zealand, are the same characters going to have the same conversations with government. And so we see the insurers, we see the banks, we see the financial institutions who clearly have expertise in this space, and I get that and that's fantastic, but they've also got an ulterior or a specific motive, you know, which isn't ulterior, it is about profit. So who else is actually coming to the table other than the same cast of characters to talk about what is at risk and what we should do? I'd like to see that conversation broadened out and it truly being about, you know, just talking about value other than just property as well. The current government has narrowed the conversation down to right it to being only about the property market, where climate change and climate adaptation is far more broader than that.
As we approach the next general election at the end of this year, are you optimistic at all about the extent to which political parties will step up on climate policy?
No, not really. I mean, I think that if you look at where climate change is sitting on the policy radar with most advanced economies, not just in New Zealand but other countries as well, it's taken a backseat to concerns around the economy and concern geopolitical conversations as well and concerns. So until we can actually have a mature conversation and see that climate change intersects with these others, I don't have much hope in terms of increasing our awareness and doing something proactively about climate change.
In the coming years, what do you think should be our priorities for our political leaders, but also in the community? I suppose we all have a role to play, and even as individuals, we have a role in responding to what's happening in order to effectively prepare for the array of climate impacts that we are likely to face in Aotearoa and obviously, of course, across the world.
Yeah, I think the conversation really is about being able to make the connection between, oh, I'm getting, you know, my house is being flooded, to, oh, we're not actually putting a tax on agriculture emissions. So, you know, what are we doing with mitigation? What is our responsibility? You know, are we stepping up as a country? Are we addressing mitigation and adaptation? What are we doing in climate change? You know, making those sort of connections is really critical, and that's what I think needs to happen at, you know, all levels of society. Everyone has a role to play in making those connections and talking about the systemic issue of climate change and how it does intersect with all these things that matter, and more increasingly so. And because until we actually are able to make that connection, we're not actually going to be able to address the root cause. It'll just be, you know, building a bit of a seawall here or putting in EV chargers there, when that really isn't what we need. We need across the board systems level thinking. The most important thing when people listen to and think about climate change is that it's actually a political issue, and if it's a political issue, then awareness is really critical, and so is communication. So to not feel like it's your own personal responsibility to go around reducing your carbon footprint, that is of course important, but more importantly, it's about having conversations with other people and to help other people to, and yourself, to see the connections between what is presented to us as completely separate issues and problems when they're all interlinked.
That was University of Auckland lecturer on sustainability, Sasha Mayer, and climate scientist Dr. Kevin Trenberth talking about the extreme weather conditions in New Zealand in the context of climate change and policy.
That was The Green World.
Are our affairs current?
Richard, great question.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Clever by Horn.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
The government had announced meat would be inspected by officers employed by meat companies rather than independent inspectors, as is the current model. The PSA's National Secretary, Fleur Fitzsimmons, says companies will be able to cut corners in terms of inspection and bow to company pressures if this privatization were to go ahead. She also says the privatization can impact New Zealand's reputation as a meat exporter as well. So what is the PSA's proposal about the privatisation of meat inspection?
Well, we're asking the government and the Ministry for Primary Industries to shelve plans to privatise export red meat inspection. We are doing this because our meat inspectors, who currently work for Assure Quality, know that if meat companies were put in charge of meat inspection, the independence is lost and quality will suffer as a result. We know that meat inspectors will be under pressure from the company to let defects go through. And when I'm talking about defects, it's very important to our export market's reputation. Defects like cancers in meat, defects like urine or fecal matter, which are picked up by the Assure Quality independent meat inspectors and not allowed to continue along the chain. So those meat inspectors currently employed by Assure Quality are really guardians of New Zealand's red export meat industry. And it's very important to farmers and to our economy. So we're really asking the government to shelve these plans to put the companies in charge of meat inspection and keep Assure Quality, who are doing an excellent role, a system that is not broken, and to leave it be.
And so what is the current meat inspection procedure?
So at the moment, independent meat inspectors are employed by Assure Quality. They are present as employees of Assure Quality at freezing works, meat chains all over New Zealand. They play an absolutely critical role in standing up to meat company pressure not to let defects through, not to let cancer in meat through, making sure that urine and fecal matter is not on carcasses before they go to our important meat market. And actually, New Zealand's reputation internationally means that we can command premium pricing of meat in overseas markets. And that is a reputation that has been built by the importance of independent meat inspection done by Assure Quality. We're really clear that the government needs to shelve these plans and that they are putting New Zealand's international reputation at risk. And that's really why we want to see these plans shelved immediately. And really what we're asking is that the voice of meat inspectors who have made their position very clear in our submission be given weight. These are the experts. These are the people who, in many cases, have been doing this work for over 20 years, are saying to MPI, they're saying that there will be employer pressure to let defects go through the chain, that there will be pressure from other people that they work with, that there will be time pressure because meat companies are focused on the bottom line more than they're focused on quality. And that's the concern, is that there's a commercial pressure on meat companies and meat inspection that doesn't arise when Assure Quality runs the meat inspection, because they are an independent, state-owned enterprise that run in the public interest instead of the meat company's interest. And we think that's absolutely critical to New Zealand's future.
So just playing the devil's advocate here for a second, because meat is such an important export to New Zealand and indirectly the meat companies as well, wouldn't the meat companies assure that their product is safe regardless of who inspects it?
Well, that's not been the experience of our meat inspectors. So they might think that they are assuring the product is safe, but they do not have the expertise built up over years that independently employed meat inspectors through Assure Quality have. We know of instances where meat companies have put pressure on meat inspectors to let defective meat through and not stop chains. Now, every time the chain is stopped, it does have a big price impact. That means that it takes longer to process the meat and it has a significant impact on the bottom line of the meat companies. The clear message from independent meat inspectors is that private, profit-driven meat companies put pressure on inspectors to let defective meat through. So We know already that this happens. It happens in the current model, but meat inspectors have the ability to stand up against it. If we design in meat company inspection, you get rid of that ability for the inspectors to stand up against meat company pressure.
PSA has also said that the privatisation of meat inspection can increase costs on small businesses. How exactly will this happen?
Yeah, that's right. Well, Assure Quality, who are the current state-owned enterprise charged with meat inspection for export meat, did an analysis through BDO. BDO are an independent contracting firm that came in to Assure Quality, looked at their current model, looked at the training that they put in to the meat inspectors, and did an analysis of how much it will cost for meat companies to set up a meat inspection service and then to run it. They did a case study and they showed annual costs for a single meat chain would increase by over 20%, which is a significant cost increase when this government says that it's about efficiency. And actually what we know is that that cost will be faced by small processors more than the bigger ones. They will be hit harder by the cost increases. And look, the other baffling thing about this whole proposal is that Assure Quality's current model is accepted by trading partners. It's safe, it's compliant. There's no international market asking for a move away from this independence. And so it's going to increase costs. It's going to put our meat, international meat reputation on meat at risk. There really is no reason to be doing this. It's baffling to us why the government would want to play, you know, even put this at risk.
And so at the moment, what percentage of small to medium-sized companies export New Zealand meat overseas versus how many large chains export New Zealand meat overseas?
It is dominated by the large chains, but increasingly small providers are trying to find a way through in the market. And there are some international markets that are quite interested in how they make sure that, for example, sustainably grown meat is available in supermarkets. Retailers like Tesco in the United Kingdom and others in Europe are demanding higher standards when it comes to climate change. But also we know that in the past, in the United States, there has been contamination scandals that have had tragic consequences. We know that fecal matter must not be on meat that is consumed by humans. We cannot have a situation where fecal matter contaminates meat that enters international markets. And that's what this proposal puts at risk.
Is this whole meat inspection process done right from the start to the finish in the factory, or is this sort of really done in the factories themselves?
This is something that happens on the chain, but Assure Quality does provide a lot of work, a lot of research and assessment work for meat companies about how to make sure that food is genuinely safe, that it can be consumed, and do provide a whole lot of other testing and support to meat companies and others. And so you are going to lose a whole lot of institutional knowledge and memory, not just by meat inspectors, but Assure Quality who support this work. It is an absolutely critical part of New Zealand's export industry. And we know that there is some concern among farmers. There is some concern among meat companies, particularly because the proposal requires a privatised model. It should at least allow those meat companies and those suppliers that do want to use Assure Quality to do so. But this proposal is really just requiring or mandating privatisation, which we think is such a backward step. It should be shelved. The situation as it currently operates is not broken, and we're really calling on the government, MPI and farmers to listen to what is at stake here, because it is a very risky proposal that will have damaging consequences for farmers, for our export industry, but also for New Zealand's reputation as a trading partner in a whole lot of goods.
And finally, knowing that meat is obviously a crucial export to New Zealand's economy, what good would privatisation of meat inspection do?
This is the problem. This is a absolutely critical export market. Farmers' livelihoods depend on New Zealand's reputation internationally. Assure Quality has an excellent reputation when it comes to independent meat inspection. They train meat inspectors. We have career meat inspectors who have developed industry knowledge, who have developed expertise when it comes to assessing meat in high-pressure situations, and who stand up to meat companies when required. And look, it's not always required, but when it is, it's absolutely critical that that independence is there on the chain, and that a conflict of interest between being employed by a meat company and then trying to inspect that meat company's meat doesn't occur. So this is, there is no sound argument for the privatisation of meat inspection. It will be more expensive and it will be dangerous, and that's why it needs to be urgently shelved by government.
That was the PSA's Fleur Fitzsimmons on the privatisation of meat inspection.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Dr. Kushla McGovern, National MP Ryan Hamilton, Dr. Kevin Trenberth, the University of Auckland's Sasha Mayer, and the Public Service Association's Fleur Fitzsimmons. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Jen.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.